I'm Drew McDaniel. I'm a lead program manager in the Microsoft Azure team, and I've been focusing on Windows workload in IaaS. So I'll be covering two sessions. One session is going to cover how we put together the Windows workload and how that works on Azure, giving you some technical depth and architecture on how that works. The second session, we're going to cover a lot of the best practices and some of the common pitfalls that people have in using the Windows workload in Azure. When I'm not at work, which is a rare amount of time, I spend it with my three daughters, pretty much taking them to dance routines and dance competitions almost throughout the year.
And we're back at the Level Up Azure for IT Pros week, if you will. My name is Rick Claus, and I'm joined by Drew McDaniel. And we're going to be talking a little bit about, for the next session or two, we're going to be talking specifically around the Windows workload, what we can do, how we can deploy it, how we can manage it, how to deploy it more effectively, and a variety of other topics, including another module coming up after this one, which is a bit more around some architecture and stuff like that. But we already know a little bit about you from the intro video, but Drew, just, you know, why don't you give us a quick little recap of name, how long you've been here, and then what you're going to be talking about.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rick. Hi, guys. I'm Drew McDaniel. I've been at Microsoft for almost 18 years now, and I've worked across the Windows Server business, file services, and for the last almost 4 years now, working in the infrastructure as a service in Azure. And so that's what we're going to be talking about how Windows on Azure kind of come together and the things you can do. And then we'll follow it up in a separate session in a bit that's going to go into a little bit deeper on the architecture. Most of the content here we'll be talking about will be specific to Windows. There will be some things that are generic and will apply to all content in Azure Virtual Machines, and so we'll cover that as we go through it.
Okay. And just a reminder to everybody that is following us live, you are able to ask questions on the main Channel 9 page. Channel 9, the name is dn.com. There is a form down below. We will get to those questions throughout the day and throughout the session as well. And if you're on Twitter, you're also welcome to tweet us at the hashtag LevelUpAzure, or you can ping me directly at @RicksterCDN. But Drew, man, let's actually go off and dive in and just kind of go with this, man.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you, Rick. So in this session, we're actually going to go through a set of kind of topics. We're just going to pick a set of things, and we're going to deep dive into them a little bit. Corey gave us a nice overview of virtual machines in Azure, a broad set of things. And so we're going to pick a few of these things that we're going to dive into. These are really based on the set of things that we hear from customers, the challenges that customers have, the areas we've wrote some blog posts, so a lot of the content here comes from some things we've put up there today already. So in those cases, we'll reference that existing content so you can get the next level of depth in there. And of course, as Rick mentioned there, we can take a few questions as we go through this in the specific area. So the first area we're going to talk about is images and disks in Azure and specifically how those work on Windows. Now, in Azure, we structure the artifacts that you can create virtual machines. There's really three primary artifacts. The first one is what we call a disk with an operating system. This is what you would have when you would start from a virtual machine on premises and you were to upload that to Azure. It's something that's already been configured, it's running, it's working, and you really just need to put it into a host and light it up. The next one is what we call an OS image. And for those of you that's been working on infrastructure service since the start, this is our first the images that we had. The difference between a disk with an operating system and an OS image is that the OS image is always copied before being attached to a virtual machine container and started up in the system. Also, the OS image is always generalized. So in the case of Windows, that means using sysprep. And we'll walk through what that entails and how you can do the sysprep on that machine. The final and the third artifact that we have, and we'll look at these, is what we call a VM image. And a VM image takes off where the OS image left. It takes not only the operating system disk, but it also includes potentially the data disks. So you can have, and we'll show how we have these in the portal today, you can have an operating system disk with up to 16 data disks in that image. It also allows you to have images that are already specialized. And so instead of going through the normal configuration process of joining domain, setting the host name, that specialized image, just you pick up and run with that. Now, in the case of Windows, what you end up doing is to prepare an image is starting with this tool called sysprep. And this just gives you a quick overview, a picture of what it ends up looking like. We'll go through a demo and get through a lot more depth and exactly what happens.
To quickly clarify, for folks that have been doing Windows images for a while now, they're familiar with the sysprep tool. This is the exact same sysprep tool. You just happen to be running it from a machine that's up in Azure to be able to go off and capture this.
That is correct. It's the exact same sysprep tool. Mm-hmm. There's some caveats when you're running that. You just want to run it in a specific format, so it's generalized and you shut down. The other thing that, the answer file that you supply into Windows if you're running it and been using it on-premise, Azure generates that. And we'll talk a little bit how Azure generates that. And so you want to make sure not to supply an answer file on that disk when you run sysprep, but okay. Otherwise it's the tools that you know and love, or at least know, mm-hmm. depending on how much you've used these tools and the success you've had.
Okay.
We also want to talk about, and where it comes into very interesting, is the management of the drives, the data drives, the temporary storage drives in the virtual machine. Now, if you saw Corey's session, he mentioned that the D drive in Windows is a temporary storage drive. We'll show that in the virtual machine, but it's important to remember that is local within the virtual machine. It is not stored in external blob storage, and so that can be lost or will be lost if the machine is deallocated from the system. If you change the size, it is truly temporary storage. We will talk later on about some things that you can do with temporary storage and some of our recommendations, but it is for data that you do not intend to continue to use. For example, we will automatically, when you provision the virtual machine, we'll put the page file on temporary storage because that's the kind of thing that does not need to be persisted over time, but just needs to be there when the VM's running. Mm-hmm. Now, sysprep itself, when you run sysprep, it will reset the drive letters. So one of the things we're going to talk through is how you manage your drive letters, both the CD-ROM device, the D drive storage, the temporary storage, and your persistent drives, which is one area where we see some customers have some challenges there. So we'll deep dive into that. And then finally, the storage spaces. You'll want to recreate storage spaces as part of scripts if you're using storage spaces with virtual machines.
Mm-hmm. And just to do a quick little level set again, this is after you've already gone ahead and provisioned using, for instance, the gallery or a PowerShell command or something like that, of a stock of a quote-unquote stock image of a Windows server inside the Azure VM gallery, correct?
Correct. Yeah, so that could be an image that you've deployed out of the gallery that we have in Azure. Mm-hmm. It also could have been a machine you'd brought up from on-premise that you really like, that you were then provisioning and sysprepping in Azure. And mm-hmm. so you have the flexibility to do the image that you, the VM that you brought, or one from the stock gallery.
Okay, so just from a simplicity perspective, you have the ability to go through with the gallery and just answer a couple of quick questions with a quick create, as an example, to have a VM up and running in a very, very quick succession.
Exactly, right. Exactly.
Okay, good.
All right, so let's go in, and we'll flip over to doing a little bit of a demo of the VM image. And so, we're gonna move over. Now, one thing as we go through the session today, you will find that we actually have two current portals in Azure. Mm-hmm. We have what is we call our vCurrent portal, or the portal that is generally available. That's what we're showing right here. We'll also be talking about a portal experience that's under development. It's in preview right now, and it enables some new functionality that just doesn't quite exist in the existing portal. But at this time, we'll actually be walking through a little bit of both. In this specific demo, we're going to start with the generally available portal, the vCurrent portal here, for this process. Now, what I have here is I have a set of machines that I have configured. These I had went through and deployed from the gallery. Let me just show that because I know Corey didn't get a chance to go through here. When you click the plus sign, it brings up the set of items that you can use. We were looking at virtual machines, and so it starts off highlighting compute. The other services, data services, application services, and network are shown down here. When you're using virtual machines, network is a very interesting thing, and I think there'll be some later sessions kind of deeper diving into network.
Yep, that's going to be covered on the second day of this.
Excellent. So that will be a great session to capture. So here we look at the virtual machines. When you go to create, there's really two forms. You can actually do what we call a quick create, where you just basically give the most basic information about the machines, the image that you want to use, and the size, location, or you can have the more full-fledged experience, which is the gallery. And the gallery allows you to view the different images. You can sort based on Windows Server. We can come in here and select our SQL Server images. As Corey mentioned, we have a large variety of partners supplying images. So we've got Ubuntu CoreOS image, and a large set, and there's even a larger set that's available in the preview portal. But this is the set we have here. The line divider here shows you the images that you have created, and we'll talk about this. In fact, what we're trying to do here is we're wanting to go through the process to create one of these images. I'm actually going to create an image, and one of these we'll look at in a bit of one that was set up a little bit earlier. But our goal is to take a virtual machine, and in this case, we actually got this virtual machine that's got two disks on it, and we're going to image that. And so if we look here, we can drill into our virtual machine, scroll down in here, and it shows a set of disks. So what we have here is the operating system disk, labeled here as the OS disk, and then two persistent data drives. When we go into the virtual machine, we'll also see a fourth drive, which is that temporary storage. So let's go ahead and connect up to the virtual machine. The portal allows you to get a RDP file that you can then connect into the virtual machine. Enter our password. And now we're connecting into that virtual machine, going over the internet, connecting into that virtual machine to get the desktop of the virtual machine.
So again, just for people that have not used Azure before as of yet, this RDP file is using a custom port. It's not the standard 3389 port that's there. This one here happens to be, I forget what it was, in the 5000s or 6000s.
Correct. Right, it would actually, we're showing that here. If we go into endpoints, endpoints. And so we've got one automatically configured for PowerShell, correct, remote access, and then remote desktop.
Right. So in case you ever needed to recreate this or you lose it, you can always come back to the portal and just grab it. Or you can just modify the port number and then hit that IP address that's there.
And we randomize the port, especially on the RDP. It's a security defense in depth, actually. So mm-hmm. that if something's scanning the internet trying to find these things, it's a little bit harder for a bad guy to find it. There's also, this is all part of layers of security. And if you look at Corey had those concentric rings.
Right.
This is just one of those layers of many, many layers of security.
I like to use the term defense in depth.
Yes.
Yeah, this is not the only piece.
Not the only piece. It's a very, very minor
just
piece.
Just one small thing. And a quick little tip, the option for the portal did give you the option of saving this file. Normally what I do is I actually have folders in my OneDrive or on my local machine that has my different projects and my different demos and sort of stuff that I save connections to if I need to go off and interact with these guys with the RDP.
Yes, and you can do some advanced things there. You can save the password in those cases. And then saved on your local machine only. It's not being saved in Azure, and so it's a little easier to connect and do different things. Mm-hmm. All right, so we've got our virtual machine. And as I mentioned, so let me just bring up disk management. So bring up the command prompt and go to disk management. This will allow us to view the drive configuration on this virtual machine. So as we saw in the portal, we've got the OS drive here. Their C drive, the temporary storage is a D drive. The reason temporary storage lands on D is OS drive and the temporary storage drive are configured on the SATA bus virtually. Mm-hmm. The way that Windows operates, it always goes through and it's actually going to put C and D, the drives on SATA bus first. It'll preference the operating system disk to see if it's available. The persistent drives that are backed by Azure Storage are then surfaced into the SCSI bus. Mm-hmm. And so the way that Windows operates, then it will go through and put drive letters on those automatically second after the C and D drive.
I don't know if this is a good time or not, but that was actually one of the questions that came up. And this one here was from, who was it there? That's this one here. I think it was... sorry, I can't see the monitors there. Basically asking about the drive letter for the temp disk. You mentioned you're able to control some of these drive letters. I like how you just described how the OS automatically assigns them.
Correct.
Is there a flexible level of control or not at this point in time?
So
when you're bringing an on-prem up as an example?
The answer is there is and there isn't. So the way that it operates is, so our as I'd mentioned a little bit earlier, the D drive is where we paste the page file. And so you actually see here that we've got the page file on the D drive. Now, this means that it's not necessarily easy to just change the drive letter because then Windows would get a little confused, it'd go look for that page file and it's not there. So what you can do is you can move the page file temporarily to the C drive. You could run longer term with the C drive, but it's not the recommended way. You're actually then spending storage transactions going against that page file. It's really not necessary, and the performance may be a little bit lower than you get running off local storage. But you could move the page file to C temporarily, and then you could change D to another drive letter if you wanted. And then you could take one of these persistent drives and put it to D. Mm-hmm. Now the key and the thing to remember here is that when Windows discovers the drives, and so in the case if I remove the system from Azure, in case I'm pulling out of the fabric and just putting it on the shelf for a little bit, when I go deploy it again, the D drive will be stood up and it's a brand new drive.
Right.
And so what Windows is going to do is it's going to look and it's going to say, hey, I've got a new drive and I need to pick a drive letter for that. And so it's going to go through and it's going to find the first open drive letter after ignoring A and B and select that. And so the key is if I put this disk 2 as D and disk 3 as E, what we'd end up having is we'd see the temporary drive when it gets redeployed to pick F. Mm-hmm. And so if we put temporary drive at F, we would be, and we kept those two persistent drives there, that would be okay. If I were to remove those persistent drives and then have one of a situation where the D drive gets recreated, then it would take that slot that I'd removed. And so like say I removed the drive that was sitting there at D, mm-hmm. Windows would automatically place it back there and now the page file would be lost or be in the wrong place. And so it is possible to do it, but it's something you want to do with a lot of caution and ensure that you always have something taking the appropriate drive letters. You can't take the temporary storage drive and put it at like F, or sorry, put it at something like Z, because then it's likely not going to stay at Z when it gets recreated. And
right.
So it can be done. It's recommended. And then what we have here is if you can, to just leave it at D,
right.
It's the safe route to go. Mm-hmm. But there are ways to work around that if you really can't do that.
Good to know the workarounds. Good to know.
Okay. So now, why don't demo a little bit of as what we were just talking about. So here I've actually done something. It's not really a recommended way to do it, but I want to just show this, that here we've got drive H and drive G configured. Now, if you know your alphabet, you know that there's a hole between H and G, and I mentioned just a bit earlier that sysprep will reset our drive letters. Mm-hmm. And so we've configured it this way. We're going to run sysprep on the machine, and we'll show what happens. The other thing I did want to point out before we run sysprep is if we look at disk 2, if we select the properties of disk 2, go ahead and zoom in here. If you select the properties of disk 2, you'll notice that it's on LUN 0. And if we look at disk 3, we'll see that it is on LUN ID 1.
Okay.
And so Windows, when it pulls off that SCSI disk and it's going to go through, once the drive letters are reset, it's going to pick the drive letters based on the numerical order.
Mm-hmm.
And so we will end up expecting that these things don't quite lay out the way that they are right now. And we'll show what happens here.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so as I mentioned, we come in here and we're going to run sysprep. Now, sysprep you need to run from the command line. So we go into, it's at Windows System 32 sysprep. And then we just run sysprep. Now, what you want to do is we're going to generalize the machine. We want it to be configured to enter out-of-box experience, UBI, as compared to the other version is auditing mode, which is typically used more on a factory floor kind of model.
Yep.
And then when the machine is shut down, when it's completed running sysprep, we actually want it to shut down. And this will shut the machine down such that the disks are quiesced and ability for us to capture them. So I'm going to go ahead and click this to start. And it's going to start running the sysprep. It's cleaning. It's removing all of the things that are specific to that machine, removing the secrets off of that machine, such that you could use that to duplicate out multiple times. Eventually, you'd see this shut down. And what you'd end up seeing in the portal, now we're going to go back to the portal, what you'd end up seeing is it would end up going into this stop state. Now, as Corey mentioned, this stop state is one where it is still allocated, ready to be captured. If you were to leave it at this state for a long period of time, you are still paying for the compute cost, and so it's not something you want to leave for running a long term.
Mm-hmm.
That's different than if you were to click shut down in the portal. By default, this portal will shut it down in what we call a deallocated state, and that state you only pay for storage.
Right. And I believe you actually see the status of that inside the portal.
Yes,
right,
that is correct. That is correct.
Yeah.
I don't have anything to show on there right now, but yes, it would say stop deallocated directly in the portal.
Right.
Now, once the machine stops, so once jump forward and say, let's assume that the sysprep is completed, the machine is shut down. What you come in here is in the portal, there's a capture button. Now, What this capture is going to do is it's going to do what we call that VM image capture. It's going to capture the operating system disk, and then the two persistent data disks. So if we click this here, we have the option to say indicate we'd run sysprep on here. As I mentioned, you can use a specialized image, so where it's already configured, you didn't run sysprep. If you do that, you only want to run that machine by itself. You don't want it network connected to other copies of that same machine because they run into problems there. So the recommendation way, if you're going to scale out and have multiple machines, is always run sysprep. We tell the system we've run sysprep. It's also going to tell us that the machine is going to be shut down and deleted after, or sorry, it's going to be deleted afterwards. That's because with a sysprep machine, it needs to go through the normal configuration process. We really can't use the machine after we've run sysprep on it without generating that answer file.
Yep.
So I'm going to give it a name here. This is our two-disk demo. That's in the label and in our image name. And we click OK. Now the system's going to go through, and what it's doing is it's going to remove that virtual machine from the system. At this point, you'd stop paying for it, store the data drives off there into Azure storage such that we could use those. I've got a machine already, an image that I already created, and so I'd like to show you what it then looks like in the portal. So here it's going through and stopping the machine. When that finally completes, we're going to see something like the following when you go into the gallery. Now if we click on images, we'll see the one we created earlier. This is the two-disk image. We would see one that says two-disk demo, which we just named there. You can now use this, and if you click on here, it indicates the number of drives. The reason we indicate the number of drives is the number of drives available on a virtual machine increase with the size of the virtual machine. So our base machine, our base A1 or D1 VM allows you to have the OS disk and two data drives. If you had something that had, say, 16 data drives, you'd need one of our larger virtual machines.
Right. While we're here just for 1 second, we actually had a question that was kind of relevant here. Hugo was asking about what happens with any data disks that you made from an image. What does it happen with VM data disks when we made an image from a VM? So you're going to basically be showing that one here coming up. But the other one is from Srihar, was asking about on-premise machines. So you mentioned the ability to take an on-premise machine that maybe is physical and you converted it to a VHD. Do you have to do anything else to be able to bring it up into the Azure world, possibly a sysprep or something else?
Yes, so as I mentioned, so if you have a physical machine, in some way, shape, or form, you need to get that physical machine converted over into virtual.
Right.
So you can use like a disk to VHD tool from SysInternals, or there's a large number, there's some tools in System Center that allows you to convert a existing physical machine over to a virtual machine. Then you're going to upload those VHD files into Azure. Now, the VHD files in Azure, they need to be the VHD format.
Yeah.
They need to be fixed VHD sizes. The operating system disk needs to be 127 gigs or lower. And then the data drives need to be 1 terabyte or lower.
Okay. And likewise as well, they also have to be generation one.
And the virtual machine needs to be generation one, which is actually captured by the VHD format.
Right. No problem. Perfect.
Yes. And so then you can, again, you can run sysprep on there and bring it up as an image. Or if you are not running sysprep on there and you just, it's running, let's say it's your SQL server and you want to run it in the cloud, you can just bring it to the cloud. It'd show up as a disk here. And so you wouldn't have checked that I've run sysprep on this. And you'd just be able to boot the machine.
Okay.
So really, it depends on what you're doing. You can either bring that image, bring it up as an image or bring it up as a disk. Now, what is going to end up happening if we were going to go through and deploy this? I actually have the third configuration here. Now this is the machine that was deployed from that image, and we're going to open this up, and I'll show you. We want to show what results in this configuration. So now this machine has been deployed, and the drive letters have been reset by the sysprep process, and Windows rediscovered the drives and placed drive letters automatically on there. And so, as we were expecting, the temp storage stayed at D, but here that volume that was H gets relabeled to E. That's that first drive letter slot after it, and the drive that was, we were calling G, actually moved over to F because that was the next spot after that. So what I want to show here is if you have an application, you want to keep those at that previous drive lettering, You would want to load in a startup script that's going to go looking at either the LUN ID or the volume label and reconfiguring the drive letters. It's certainly possible once you've reconfigured it, the drive letters will be maintained through the lifetime of the VM for those persistent drives. Mm-hmm. Because those drives move with that virtual machine. And so I could change this to H, and as long as I don't run sysprep, it would stay H.
Okay, and then also just to clarify as well, persistent storage means that there's data on these drives. That data is still there.
Correct. I didn't have anything, but that data would stay there. That data is stored into Azure Storage as a page blob, and that would be persistent, whether the VM's running, stopped, or whatever you're doing
with
that.
Cool.
Okay. All right, so let's come back to the presentation. And continue. Now, there's a couple things that when we go through and we deployed that VM in the portal that you're allowed to do the 80% case, the common case, so you can set the virtual machine name, you select the location you want to deploy to, but there are some things that are not available in the portal right now. And for the customers, as this being a little bit of a deeper dive, I did want to highlight the things that you can do that's API or PowerShell only. So using PowerShell, when you deploy that virtual machine, you can join an Active Directory domain. You can even specify the OU to place that machine in. You can configure how you want Windows Update. We, by default, deploy in the most secure manner possible. So we deploy it out there with Windows Update enabled. Mm-hmm. And so if you just deploy your virtual machine, you're going to be getting patches on the normal cycle. The one thing we do change in there, instead of being exactly on 3 a.m., we kind of spread that out so not all the machines are downloading the patches at exactly the same time. Mm-hmm. If you want to disable that, you can use PowerShell to disable that. You can install your X509 certificates. So if you're running SSL, you're running a website, you may deploy those certificates. Configuring time zone. This piece here, custom data, is something that is a little bit of a secret tool that not a lot of people know about. It's heavily used in the Linux world through a thing called CloudInit. But what that does is, and you can use this on Windows, is you can specify a configuration file. And that configuration data then is just passed into the virtual machine and laid down in this directory in the system drive under Azure Data, custom data.bin. And then your application can use that as you want. And so it's a way to push some configuration into the virtual machine. We'll go through a lot of other ways to automate your virtual machine, some things we've actually been continuing to add in Azure over time. But this is another option for doing some configuration to the virtual machine. And then finally, we'll talk a little bit about WinRM a little bit later, but this WinRM is what enables you to do remote PowerShell. And so this allows you to configure that to be HTTPS or HTTP, the certificates that you want to do, and you have some flexibility there. Okay. So that's a quick summary. Oh, sorry. And then finally, we also have a set of things that you want to look at if you are uploading the virtual machine. A lot of these we've talked about. So if you're uploading a specialized machine to Azure, if you're running it from the image, we take care of this automatically for you. But if you're actually bringing your own thing and you're not going through the imaging process, you'd want to configure this. Page file to the temp drive, as we recommended earlier. As I mentioned, it's best to avoid using D drive for persistent storage for your persistent drives if you can. There are ways to work around that if you need to. Pointing the to the Azure Activation Service. So if you upload your VM, Windows has two modes. It's running either at what we call retail or in volume license.
Right.
When it's in volume license, it goes and gets an activation server every 7 days by default. And so in Windows Azure, we have an activation server for your virtual machines. If you bring it from on-prem, you actually want to go and configure to point to that activation server. This blog post gives you the details on how to do that, how to configure that. Mm-hmm. It also goes through if you actually have a retail image and you want to convert it over to virtual volume license, you can do that as well. And that post has it. Sand policy. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, when you're also talking about moving machines up and then having to go off and reconfigure things like the KMS server for activation, there's a question that actually came up here from Kelvin, was asking about taking a VM image that you have up in Azure and bringing it back down again. Is that also possible to do?
Yeah, so great question, Kelvin. And the answer really kind of depends. Now, from the technology standpoint, the VHD format, you can absolutely bring those down and run them on-premise. And in fact, there's a commandlet that makes this easy called save Azure VHD to bring that down. What you do want to look into, depending on what it is, and I'll talk to you on Windows, is the licensing.
Right.
So if you deployed that from our marketplace and you're actually paying for the service, the software on a per hour basis, typically the license there is not does not allow you to just bring that down and run it for free. Mm-hmm. However, with Windows, what it is you can bring it on premise. It's automatically configured for volume licenses. And so you need to have it point back to an activation server right. on premise. If you have that and you have the appropriate license mm-hmm. licenses for the machine, then you're fine to do that on Windows.
And that also, same thing applies also if you're in applications, like for instance SQL, licensing applies for that when you're bringing it back down or if you're bringing it up.
That's exactly. So technically, you can absolutely move them back and forth. We'll put an asterisk there as to check the licensing. I want to stay away from any kind of legal advice. I am not a lawyer, thank goodness here. But
We have not passed the 7-day certification course on licensing.
Yes. The other two pieces to mention here, SAN policy to online automatically is the convenient way to do that. And then finally, dissignature collisions. You typically don't see this much, again, if you're doing image, but what happens here is each operating system disk has or actually any of the disk on the machine has a signature. If for any reason you make a copy of that and then you take a copy of a data disk or operating system disk and attach it to a virtual machine that has the same disk signature, it throws things off. And so mm-hmm. you really have to watch that. You'll notice this, the machine will actually say, do you want to bring this disk online because of the signature collision? If you say yes, and that is your OS disk, it will cause problems in reboot. There's a great article by Mark Rosinovich that shows you how to fix that. But again, it's just something to watch out for if you are bringing your own specialized disks mm-hmm. and attaching to machines. If you're using images, we fix that up on Windows as we go through the provisioning process, so you don't need to worry about it.
I'll just also mention as well, from a 2012 and 2012 R2 server perspective, if you're going with the storage spaces on top of your data disks, the storage spaces information is stored with the disk.
That's
correct. So as long as you bring all those disks back online with the appropriate VM, you can basically re-import that storage space into the VMs you just provisioned.
Exactly. Okay, so that summarizes our walkthrough disks, images, and some of the challenges with drive letters. Mm-hmm. Now the next area I want to talk through, this extra area applies both to Windows and Linux, and it comes into using storage account and our storage account management. Now, As we mentioned, the disks in Azure are being stored in Azure Storage. And so what we have here in this kind of a diagram is the OS image. And so this is something that, like we were just looking at with those two disk, you would also have data disk images there. Those get copied to in the same storage account and then connected to that virtual machine. Now, one of the things you definitely want to watch out for as you're getting to larger numbers of virtual machines inside your subscription is the absolute number of active disks, whether they're OS or data, within a single storage account. So our single storage account, our recommendation is 40 disks using our standard storage. We've got a new thing coming out called premium storage, and we won't be talking about that today. I think we'll have another session. We'll deep dive a little bit into premium storage, how that changes. But with standard storage, you just want to remember 40 active disks. And the reason for this is that there's 500 IOPS per disk that the system allows, and there's 20,000 IOPS in the storage account. And just so by division, if you stay at 40 or under, you stay safe. You then can spread. Now, if you need more than 40 disks, you can spread that out across storage accounts. You can have up to 100 storage accounts within your subscription, giving you a total of 4,000 disks within the subscription. Now, as I mentioned, when you have your custom image, we're going to copy the image over to the disk that we're going to be created within that same storage account. So if you only can have 40 disks in a storage account, there can be some challenges as far as how many disks that you end up having, how many storage accounts you need to have. And so one useful tidbit here is to separate your OS disks into one set of storage account and your data disks into another. And so you copy and you have up to 40 OS disks in each storage account, and then you can have your data disks in separate storage accounts. That way you only have to have your OS image copied to a fewer number of storage accounts. To move data around, you can use a copy blob API or the PowerShell tool for that. In PowerShell, that's start Azure copy blob. And that allows you to move data from one storage account to another within Azure. Actually leverages the Azure storage system to do that copy operation, so you don't need to do it yourself. You don't need to download it and upload it.
I'm a little bit of a fan of third-party tools. Nice GUI interfaces to be able to do them between the different storage accounts myself.
Yes, those are nice. I'm clearly a PowerShell fan, as you'll see through this. But yes, you know, and the great thing is with Azure is there's a lot of different options. There's a lot of third-party tools. We publish out the APIs. We encourage third parties to build upon those. And the idea is that, you know, the customers can use what best suits them. And so as you saw between Rick and I, you know, we have a little bit of a different where we fall to. Again, there's a blog post that talks you through moving this between storage accounts if you want. And then finally, if you're using storage spaces, you do want to use the PowerShell or tool to configure the number of columns when you have 8 or more disks. By default, storage spaces uses 8 columns, so it means for each write, it's actually going across 8 disks. Mm-hmm. If you actually have 16 disks or something greater than 8, you want to make sure to create your virtual disk using the commandlet such that you can actually specify the number of columns be equal to the number of disks that you want to use. Mm-hmm. All right, what I did want to do is just a quick demonstration, show some tools you can use to check on your storage usage. So if we look here in the portal, so when we come back to virtual machines, by default, it's the instances. You can select images, the images that we had just created and already existed. But here's a listing of disks. Now, if you're looking through these disks and trying to figure out and count them in the portal, that's probably not the easiest way to say, hey, am I over 40? It's a little bit of a challenge. And so my recommendation, and there's alternate solutions, is, again, jumping down to PowerShell. Two great commands with PowerShell. If you don't know what the command is, there's a thing called git command. And we're just going to say, hey, I'm doing something with disks. So let's see what there is in disks. And this dumps out those set of commands. And you say, oh, geez, git Azure disk. That's probably what we want to have. Mm-hmm. The second great tool to use in PowerShell is git help. And you can get help about this tool. Oop. Git Azure disk. And this will tell you the information you need about to use this commandlet. In this case here, I'm actually going to dump out the disk, git Azure disk. This is going to dump out the set of disks, but I'd like an easy way to consume them. So with PowerShell, I'm going to pipe this into.
It's got a typo on the first part.
Oh, thank you.
There you go.
So we're going to pipe this into export to CSV format. And I'm going to give a file here. Disks.csv. And this is going to dump it into a CSV format. And now it's very easy for me to open this up into Excel. And I can sort and parse, and I can see here. So what we've got here, this is the media link. This is the link, the URL to the machine, to the disks. And so here we could actually group this and sort this and count the disk. We use a lot of the Excel functions. So it's a nice way to actually manage that data instead of just going through the portal. Mm-hmm. And so the quick thing there again is git Azure disks. Oops. Git Azure disks, export CSV, and then put it into a file.
Nice.
All right.
We actually had a question that came up about being able to use those disks across different accounts, or at least across different not subscriptions, but if you have an enterprise subscription, as an example,
right?
Are you able to have some central ones and then be able to leverage those ones across your different projects?
Yeah. Now, so the blog post I pointed to earlier that talked about moving virtual machines, that gives you the information, the copy blob API right. that I mentioned there. Allows you to copy across storage accounts, mm-hmm. and you can even copy across subscriptions. For that matter, you can even copy across instances of Azure. So mm-hmm. if you're a multinational and you've got instances in our Azure operated by 21 VNet, and you have instances in the Azure operated by Microsoft, you can use that copy blob operation to copy between those. It goes through and checks to see where the what the source location is. If it's from Azure, mm-hmm. it's going to optimize and only copy the bits that are changed and are non-zero. But you can even use that to copy from any arbitrary URL that you can get. You can do a git operation against.
Very cool.
So it's very, very convenient, very useful tool to do. All right, so that's kind of the high level on disks and storage accounts and leveraging storage accounts. As I mentioned, we'll talk a bit more on premium storage in the future. The key thing is that premium storage largely is very similar to what we have here. You create storage accounts, you put disks into those storage accounts. So there's not going to be a dramatic change. It's the same functionality. The dramatic change that you're going to see in premium storage is just the speed of the storage, the lower latency, and the higher throughput that we'll see there. And so that's where the fun comes with that system. Now, so the next area we want to talk about, we get some questions. So in Azure, we've got the virtual machines. The virtual machines are clearly something that I'm a big fan of. I've been working on them since I came to Azure. But we also have a great web and worker platform as a service roles. And so a common question comes up, how do I use these together? What should I use? The recommendation is if you can use the platform as a service role, it's for Windows, as we're showing here, you know, an IaaS application, web services, it's a great solution to use. The IaaS role is what is great for kind of your bring up from on-premise, using those in Azure. IaaS also is the thing that you're going to need to use to run Linux. But if you want to mix and match those together, really the key sauce here is virtual network. Mm-hmm. So what you want to do is you do your deployment of your web and worker role into a virtual network. Customers will typically deploy that into a specific subnet. So you might deploy your front-end web services into that virtual network. And then you deploy the IaaS components into that same virtual network. The virtual network scales to over 2,000 virtual machines, virtual machine instances. And so it allows you to kind of mix and match those very nicely. Those all stay behind in a data center network side network, so they're not traversing and communicating over the public internet.
Mm-hmm. And just in case you're wondering, because you're watching a live stream or you're watching this recorded, day four content is actually going to be covering specifically the PaaS piece from both the SQL perspective and also web services perspective.
Great.
There's no rivalry between you guys, is there? Between PaaS and IaaS?
Oh, you know what? We want whatever the was best for customer to be available.
There. Very political answer. I like that.
Yeah, I
like
mean, when it really comes down to it, our goal is to give the right tools to the customers for the job that they have. Customers have all kinds of different things, and the life cycle that an individual customer goes through changes. And so really, there isn't a rivalry there as much as just, you know, making sure that we're providing the right thing for those customers.
Cool.
Okay, now the last piece I want to dive into a little bit is coming back to the automation, some of the scripting. One of the things that you're going to see as you start using cloud solutions is automation is a really useful thing. It is so easy to spin up a set of virtual machines that you really like to jump in and use some automation where possible. And so we'll look at a set of things that we have today. Now the first one is PowerShell automation. And so, as we mentioned, each virtual machine is configured automatically, the Windows virtual machines, for remote PowerShell. This is kind of the Windows equivalent to SSH on Linux, mm-hmm. and allows you to connect in and run individual commands. And so what I'm going to do is show you how to do that. So we're going to come in here. Oops. Come to our virtual machine. Now here, I'm going to use one we're going to do some demos for in a bit, but it's a Druem AS1. We'll talk about the availability sets in a bit. In here, as you see, we've got a PowerShell, remote PowerShell port configured along with the remote desktop. Now what we're going to do is we're going to connect into this. Clear the screen here. Oops. So the way that you connect in with remote PowerShell is what we call enter PS session. Let me first get a credential. That's what I need. So we're going to create a credential object. So we're going to call this DrewM, which is the admin name I'd given, and then we're going to provide the admin password here. So now we've got that credential object saved, and now we're going to let me just grab this from thing here. I've got the example here from the availability set demo. Oop. Now, let me show you why this happened and a couple things here. So, in the enter PS session, we entered the computer name. The computer name here is the name of the web service. Mm-hmm. And so in the portal, we have the machine named AS1, but if we come back and look at that machine, we'll see that the actual internet DNS name to this is as1demo.cloudup.net. So we're connecting to it on that name. We're using the port that was configured for that virtual machine. We're going to use SSL, and we gave the credential. But then it popped up and said, hey, you know, we failed the following because the server certificate on the destination computer was not correct or not trusted. So what happens when we deploy a virtual machine, we create a self-signed SSL certificate to be used for WinRM. Now, we'll show you how you can leverage and use that self-signed certificate automatically here. You also, as I mentioned earlier, if you're using PowerShell, you can provide a fully verified actual signed certificate that could be provided with that virtual machine, and you could connect using that, then you wouldn't get this pop-up here. Mm-hmm. What we're going to do, though, is if we're using the self-signed certificate, what we do in our machine, and I've got this certificate here, I'm going to load up, let's see, oops, put it over here. The demo cert here. Now, what happened, I went to the machine and connected. There's multiple ways you can get this certificate. You can download it through the APIs. You can get it through PowerShell. You can just connecting to the endpoint. It'll give you the certificate. And I'm going to take this certificate. I'm going to install it into my current user profile. And what you need to do is I need to place the certificate in the following location. Let me zoom in here so we can see this. But we're going to put that certificate into the trusted root certificate authority. Mm-hmm. What that's going to do is it's going to say, hey, when we see a certificate from that CA, we're going to trust that. And so we'll get a warning, a pop-up here. It says, hey, are you sure you want to trust this certificate? It tells you all the information. You want to say yes, because that we know this came from Azure. From the portal, you can check the thumbprint to see that this is the certificate. That allows you to prevent any kind of a man-in-the-middle security mm-hmm. tactic, again, these defense in depth. But if that's the right certificate, and I can vouch that is the right thumbprint here, we go ahead and say, yes, this was imported. And now when we come back to our machine here and do our InterPS session, it's going to go through, it sees the certificate, and now it's connected into the machine.
I like how the PS session part, and this is in PowerShell, references the fact that you're running these commands on a remote machine with little square brackets on the front
exactly,
of it.
Exactly, yeah. It's really nice. And that way you see, now if we actually did a directory listing here, let's go back to the root of the volume. Do a directory listing here. A couple things here, Windows Azure directory, the packages, mm-hmm. configuration. This is much more sparse than I actually have on my machine. So, So we're actually connected to that virtual machine. And if we wanted to run a set of commands, I've actually got a little tool here. Let me just bring this up, the script up. So you always want to, when you're running PowerShell, you want to have the Azure PowerShell configured here. And so every time that starts up, it's loading all of the Azure modules so they're available for you. And so one of the scripts I've got here is in my directory. And so what we've got here is just something that's going to grab the date and create a directory based on the date. So I can take these commands and execute them directly. And these now are executing on that remote machine, on the Azure machine. I just copy these up here, and I can now make that directory. And so I can push any kind of command that I want, just interact with it as if I was on that machine. But as you saw, it may not be the most convenient way to do it. It's a quick way to do some connections and just run some things. But there's some more advanced solutions here. Mm-hmm. And so let's continue forward. So the next example, we're going to do for automation is custom script. Now, what custom script does is it leverages a tool called extensions. what extensions are in Azure is you can specify when you deploy a virtual machine, in the case of the vCurrent portal, or after you've deployed a virtual machine, in the case of the new portal, that will allow you to run that and execute that script. So here, we're going to do the same thing. We're going to go to, now we're going to switch over to the preview portal. Let's sign in here on the preview portal real quick. Tell you what, let's just do this. This will be faster.
I'm looking back here in some of my tweets that I just did over the last little while because I found there was a really good article that a friend of mine out of the UK, his Twitter handle is DeepFat, okay. Andrew Fryer, and they actually talked about a whole bunch of things that you were doing there, like setting your credentials and being able to store them in PowerShell, mm-hmm. working remotely, about simplifying your life working with Azure PowerShell remotely by being able to set things like your storage subscription as a credential,
yep.
or as a variable, which account you're using, all that sort of stuff, as some great handy day-to-day things.
Yes.
And so
yes.
If I find that link while we're going here, I'll make sure that I put that up inside.
And that's, I mean, you know, one of the things I love with PowerShell, since I am lazy, it is so easy to find some great scripts mm-hmm. that are already out there to leverage. And so it is very convenient that way. So in the new portal, let's say I've got my virtual machine. We're going to go through and look at all the virtual machines. I'd had a shortcut here, but let me just, because I know Corey didn't get a chance to go through here. If we're browsing in the new portal, it's a similar model, but instead of having services, it starts from the action. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to browse to all of the different objects. We're going to come down here and we're going to select virtual machines. Now we get that view similar to what we had before. We can go to this AS1, select that virtual machine. And now it's bringing up information about the virtual machine, the various settings. It actually surfaces a little more information about the perf counters of the virtual machine. But down here at the bottom, we've actually got an item called extensions. So I can select the extension. All Windows virtual machines by default get a BG info extension. That's the extension that shows you information about the virtual machine,
right.
The IP addresses and things like that. But here I want to add a new virtual new extension, and I'm going to add that custom script. And so similar to what I had done before, but now I'm actually going to use the extension mechanism to push configuration. I select custom script, gives me some information about it, and here it allows me to specify the file. And so I'm just going to come in here and select the same create directory script. It's going to upload that. I don't have any arguments to that, as you saw. It's just create the directory and click on create. And it's going to go through and push that script into storage, push the configuration down to the virtual machine, and then execute that script on that virtual machine directly.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I don't have to deal with any kind of entering the sessions, entering credentials. That's all handled under the covers by Azure, which makes it very, very convenient. Now, the last thing, as I mentioned, we've gone through a couple options for configuration. We continue to invest. We have a large amount of options for doing that. So we've got a third option for automation is a thing called desired state configuration. This is great for specifying how you want your machine configured. It uses PowerShell desired state configuration to set that up and to configure the machine. It sets the machine into that consistent state. You can use Octopus for deployment and configuration, as well as what's been in the platform for a while, both Chef and Puppet, two third-party tools that work both on Windows and Linux to do some advanced configuration. So there's a lot of different tools, a lot of options to use for configuration. As I mentioned, once you start leveraging and using Azure, you tend to kind of want to do a little bit of automation because it is so easy and convenient to spin up those virtual machines and configure them as you'd like. And so with that, if there's any other questions, that's the Windows-specific component that we're going to cover this hour, and we'll go through some more details in kind of architecture in the next hour.
Definitely. One that's been up there for a little bit of time, and this is something that we haven't covered as of yet, creating images or creating machines from images. One of the questions that came up was from FP, where are Windows Desktop OS images available in the Azure Cloud?
Great question, FP. So they are available in the Azure Cloud. There is a an asterisk there. They're available for dev test use under an MSDN subscription. Mm-hmm. So if you are an MSDN subscriber, you will see you can configure a Azure subscription that's associated with your MSDN subscription. In that MSDN subscription, you will see Windows 8 and Windows 8.1 that are available. We do only support the 64-bit operating systems, mm-hmm. so you see the 64-bit versions there. But they are available, but they are specifically for dev test purposes only.
Dev test and dev test scenario.
Yes, absolutely. Now,
Dev C has a question here about the IOPS discussion that we've had, and I think he's got the number wrong. He's saying 5,000 IOPS. It's 500 IOPS. Is the limitation on a per VHD disk or per storage account? We kind of covered this one already, but
we kind of covered it. Yeah. So the it is Dev C. That's a great question. The limit is 500 per disk, and then the overall limit of IOPS in a storage account is 20,000. And so that's where we get to our recommendation of 40 disks in a storage account, mm-hmm. Because that would, the 500 times by 40 would add you up to the 20,000.
Right. Another question that came in was from, this one here came through Twitter, was asking about being able to go off and to take an image of a machine while it's running, as mm-hmm. opposed to while it's stopped. Is that something that's possible or just not recommended? You did it through the portal as an example.
Yeah, let me, I show you. It's definitely possible. Oh, we're signed out here, we'll fix it. So it's definitely possible. What it's going to do is if the machine is running, it's going to take a copy of the disk as it is right then and there. Mm-hmm. If you have a single operating system disk, that's a reasonable solution. However, if you're running something like SQL where you have data on one drive, log files on another, and the OS in another state, just taking a straight capture while it's running could lose data or it could be inconsistent because of the nature of SQL. Another big no-no is if you're running something like spaces, storage spaces, and you're spreading the writes across multiple disks. In that kind of situation, you really want to shut the machine down so that everything is fully quiesced before you take that snapshot of the running VM.
Right.
We've been working with some of our partners in Azure in the backup team, and in fact, there were some announcements earlier at TechEd of some solutions coming that actually leverage the VSS technology mm-hmm. that is in Windows to actually get that quiesced state, but just directly in the portal without using any kind of a data protection manager or some other tool. The best practice is to shut the machine down to take the snapshot. Then you're guaranteed to have a consistent snapshot.
Mm-hmm. And with that, I am going to have to say that we're going to continue on this kind of topic on the next session after the break. And so some of these questions we'll be able to bring up in there as well. And I also promise that a lot of these questions are really good fodder for some good blogging materials that I'll be sharing with the Azure IaaS engineering team and also with myself as a possible follow-ons to it. So we're going to be back after the break. It's been about 5 minutes if you're following in the live stream. And Drew's going to be back again talking a bit more on the architecture pieces and also taking some more questions after we have a little bit of a discussion.
Excellent.
So catch you back after the break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.